This podcast is brought to you by the Transitional Justice Institute at Ulster University. Learn more about our work, including our taught postgraduate programmes in gender, conflict, transitional justice and human rights, at www.transitionaljustice.ulster.ac.uk.
Hello and good day to all of our participants and attendees from across the world. My name is Catherine O'Rourke. I'm one of the co-organisers of this workshop, along with Megan Campbell and Loveday Hodson. And I also direct the Transitional Justice Institute at Ulster University, which is hosting the workshop. It falls to me to welcome you all very warmly and to thank you so much for joining in our discussions, particularly to our distinguished panellists and participants. In these introductory remarks, I'm going to speak briefly to our motivations and our objectives for convening the workshop before handing over to Megan and Loveday for their introductory remarks. So the workshop brings together key voices and stakeholders from around the world to consider how the leading instrument on women's equality, the UN Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, CEDAW, can best respect, protect, and fulfill the rights of lesbian, bisexual, and transgender women. In addition to the CEDAW committee and the independent expert on SOGI, we have participants from civil society from across Africa, Asia, the Americas, and Europe, all committed toward understanding better how international human rights law, particularly CEDAW, can be directed towards fuller equality. In putting together this workshop, we had a number of mutually reinforcing objectives. First, we wish to provide a space and a forum for a focused discussion on the question of CEDAW and sexual orientation and gender identity, an opportunity to bring together conversations that had otherwise been happening in quite dispersed spaces. Further, the contributions from our civil society colleagues will focus quite directly on what it means in practice to have rights under CEDAW violated due to one's sexual orientation and gender identity. Also more positively, to see what might be done to enhance CEDAW compliance in this area. We therefore hope that the workshop will contribute to an evidence-based to lead to a better informed discussion on CEDAW and SOGI. And to that end, in order to memorialize our discussions in this workshop and to make a contribution to this evidence base, we will be producing a written report from our discussions over the next 2 days. And we hope to turn that around quite soon and to share that with everybody here, with the CEDAW committee, and indeed more widely with the human rights system. In saying that, we are, of course, mindful that there are many themes that aren't addressed or will inevitably be under-addressed in this workshop. Rural women, girls, women with disabilities, several others. So we therefore view this workshop as the start of a conversation that all of us will continue individually and through different combinations of participants to bring in other voices and themes. Linked to that, we see the workshop as an invaluable opportunity for providing the basis for informal and formal networks among civil society, academics, and actors in the human rights system to continue to advance this area over the coming years. Ultimately, connected to all of these things, we hope that the workshop may ultimately provide some sort of tentative basis to a general recommendation on this theme from the CEDAW committee. Recognizing that this is a longer term goal, in the interim, we see real potential for a model general recommendation drafted by civil society. Likewise, to inform the work of the committee and the human rights system more broadly. So I'll turn now to Megan.
Thank you. Just to echo Catherine, thank you everyone for participating, for attending, for Zooming in, particularly for people who are, it's either really early in the morning or really late at night. We just appreciate everybody's generosity in giving their time to what we think is a really important project and endeavor. So at first glance, it might seem odd to think about CEDAW and sexual orientation and gender identity, because on a plain reading of the text of CEDAW, it doesn't inspire a lot of confidence that it's really well-placed to address the discrimination and inequalities experienced by lesbian, bisexual, trans, queer, or gender non-conforming women. The text makes no real reference to women's sexuality. There's a few off-references to family planning, but nothing really but much beyond that. Nor does it really talk much about the diversity of women's sexuality or sexual experiences. And it would be probably fair to argue there's an implicit understanding of women as being cis women within CEDAW, And there have been lots of critiques over the years that the vision of a woman in CEDAW is really a white, middle-class, sort of global North woman. And of course, over the 40 years since CEDAW came into force, there's been a lot of work done to deconstruct that kind of maybe implicit vision of what it means to be a woman within CEDAW. In part, that the text reflects this understanding of women because it was drafted at a certain period of time and reflected the concerns of the drafters about what was the pressing issues of gender equality in the 1960s and 1970s. But the great thing about all kind of human rights treaties, but and particularly CEDAW, is that they are meant to endure over a long period of time, and they're written in a way as to be evolutionary and to be dynamic and to be responsive and to new concerns about gender equality, and to be able to be reinterpreted for each generation and re-understood as to be able to address how does discrimination and inequality impact on women's equal enjoyment of their fundamental freedoms and human rights, as it says in Article 1. And the workshop today is really a response to that kind of built-in evolutionary mechanisms or tones to CEDAW. And the workshop today looks to take that step forward and think about how can CEDAW respond to discrimination against women in the context of sexual orientation and gender identity. And it's here that the work of the CEDAW committee in adopting an intersectional approach to interpreting CEDAW becomes so, so key and kind of points the way forward into the beginnings of thinking more coherently and comprehensively about sexual orientation and gender identity in CEDAW. In General Recommendation number 28, the CEDAW committee held that women inherently and inextricably experience intersectional discrimination. And this is such an exciting way to think about intersectional discrimination that women experience. So the committee was sort of saying, rather than looking at one ground in women in isolation of every other identity characteristic, it adopts what I've called a very fluid and expansive approach that really seeks to place women in context and understand how being a woman interacts with a wide range of not only identity characteristics that we recognize commonly in discrimination law, like race or age or disability, but also identity characteristics that are not commonly recognized in discrimination law, like poverty or illiteracy or prisoner status, and against cross-cutting experiences like climate change or conflict or post-conflict environments. So it really uses the concept of woman as a pivot point to understand a wide range of identities, experiences, and cross-cutting events that shape how women experience the world and how they experience discrimination inequalities. The CEDAW committee has really pioneered this exciting mandate, and it's uniquely positioned to consider how sex, gender, identity, and sexual orientation are linked, interact, and contribute to disadvantaged treatment. On the kind of more positive side of the coin, it's also imperative to understand how sex, gender, identity, and sexual orientation interact and how it can be that interaction can be a springboard for rethinking and challenging long accepted essentialist categories and point the way forward for a more transformative approach to the realization of women's equality and human rights. And perhaps the greatest insight from the CEDAW committee that can be taken forward in today's workshop is that this fluid and expansive approach to intersectionality is that lesbian, bisexual, trans, intersex, queer, gender nonconforming women are not a monolithic category in and of themselves, but there are convergences and divergences within sexual orientation, gender identity that need to be acknowledged, understood, taken into account, and in some cases celebrated. It's just really important that in respecting and protecting and fulfilling the equal rights of women in the context of sexual orientation, gender identity, it's crucial to think about how the commitment to equality in CEDAW can respond to and take account of the intersectionality within sexual orientation, gender identity. And with that, I'll now turn it over to Loveday, who will talk a little bit more about some of the key themes that we're going to be looking at over the course of the next 2 days.
Thank you, Megan. I think that Megan's identification of the transformative approach to equality that the committee has adopted is really key to our excitement and commitment about what's on offer when we look at Soji writes through the lens of the convention. So the committee, the Women's Committee's focus on gender and women's experiences means its contribution to the fast-moving global discussions on Soji rights and its contribution to addressing in particular the marginalisation of lesbian, trans, gender variant and queer women is vitally important to the discussions that are taking place. The voices and experiences of women have at times, in fact frequently, have been left behind in discussions on Soji rights. CEDAW, in its inevitable foregrounding of women, is uniquely positioned then to redress this balance and to shine a light on international human rights law's blind spots in this respect. And indeed, the committee has made a number of important interventions on Soji rights and has perhaps made a more frequent contribution in this sphere than other UN human rights treaty bodies. But this opportunity, however, comes with challenges. And with the recognition of Soji rights comes a need to address difficult questions head on. And we're really grateful that you've all agreed to take on this challenge and pressing task and joined us today in thinking about these questions. Not least, there's an imperative to respond to the apparent textual limitations of CEDAW that Megan so coherently outlined. The committee has taken a number of important steps to recognise the intersectional nature of discrimination that women experience, and in turn, the gendered subject of the treaty. Over the course of this workshop, over the next two afternoons here, we will consider how this analytical approach might be further concretised and applied in the committee's practice. This is no easy task, and there are no easy answers. While acknowledging gender diversity in broad terms orientates the committee's direction in important ways, there is considerable work to be done in understanding diverse women's experiences of discrimination and rights violations and the concrete obligations on state parties that flow from these. In what particular ways does CEDAW's general recognition of the discrimination that trans and gender variant women and girls face, for instance, translate into concrete obligations? In what ways can and should Article 5's call for states to take all appropriate measures to modify social and cultural patterns based on patriarchy and gender-based stereotypes be harnessed to further protect Soji rights? Medicalisation and pathologisation are issues that are ripe for discussion here. CEDAW has made a number of interventions with respect to criminalisation of same-sex relationships. But what obligations does CEDAW place on states to protect relationships of care when they fall outside of state parties' legal frameworks? What does it mean, for instance, to recognise the relationship rights of women in same-sex relationships, particularly when the global picture of formal relationship recognition is such a patchwork? In what ways can and might CEDAW's impressive analysis of gender-based violence against women extend to lesbian and trans women, for instance, and on migrant women seeking refuge from gender-based violence in particular? When we think about these questions, what are our shared priorities and aims? How do we answer these questions without creating further exclusions and marginalisations? As I said, there are a lot of questions for us to think about over the course of these workshops. Maintaining the intersectional approach and avoiding the lure of the analytically compelling that is in her deceptive simplicity, universal woman is an ongoing challenge. The question that inspires us today is that of how we can ensure that the impressive gains for women's rights that have been made under the convention are gains for all women and that no woman or girl is left behind. So I'm really looking forward to these discussions. We're delighted that you're here, and I'm going to pass back to Catherine now so we can start the real conversation.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Megan, and lovely for those compelling comments. Just before I proceed to our next speaker, a technical note. For those of you who are attending, who are watching the live stream, just to note that you have, you can feel free to include your written comments or questions as we things proceed, and we'll be we'll attempt to address those in the Q&A session. So moving on then, it's my great pleasure and delight to welcome our keynote speaker from the CEDAW committee, Dr. Leah Nadaria. Leah very generously got back very quickly when we asked her to make this contribution, and we're so grateful to have her. Leah is from Georgia. She's a member of the CEDAW committee since 2015. In that time, she's been a member of different working groups and task forces of the committee, including the Working Group on Communications, the Working Group on Inquiries, and the Task Force on Women in Conflict Prevention, Conflict, and Post-Conflict Situations. Leah, I will hand over to you now, and thank you again for joining us.
Thank you very much. I want to convey my warm greetings to the workshop participants, and thank organizers, Euro Asia Pacific and UK universities for enabling discussion on CEDAW and SOGI framework. I'll try to share a screen of my presentation. If it works. I'm not sure. Okay, I'll continue without presentation. I'm so glad that CEDAW committees practice in recognizing how gender-based discrimination against women intersects with and is determined by other assets of identity and the circumstances of disadvantage has positive evaluation, and that committee as a human rights treaty body is identified as making the most frequent references to sexual orientation and gender identity. CEDAW committee as a treaty body has a broad human rights mandate relating to all forms of discrimination against women without any distinction. Through the language of equality embodied in the convention is based on comparison between women and men, the committee has repeatedly insisted that the obligations contained in the convention express broader dimensions of inequality, including inequalities among women themselves. The committee has emphasized the intersectionality of all forms of discrimination, and in pursuant of definition of equality had addressed the disproportionate burdens borne by rural women, women with disabilities, women with HIV, AIDS, and LGBTI women, among others. CEDAW jurisprudence advanced in the past, and I'm sure will advance in the future, the doctrine that each person's self-defined gender identity is integral to their personality and is one of the most fundamental aspects of self-determination, dignity, and freedom. From early 90s, we can trace the evaluation of the language on human rights violations against lesbian, bi, trans, and intersexed women, and its connection to right to sexual orientation and gender identity with other substantive rights guaranteed under CEDAW. Under different articles and issues, CEDAW concluding observations include reference to sexual orientation and gender identity, and are guiding member states, as stated in Article 2F CEDAW Convention, to condemn discrimination against women in all its forms, agree to pursue by all appropriate means and without delay a policy of eliminating discrimination against women, and to undertake all appropriate measures, including legislation, to modify or abolish existing laws, regulations, customs, practices, which continue discrimination against women. Here are concluding observations that include a reference to sexual orientation and gender identity in the underlying positive aspects or concerns and the recommendations in tackling discrimination. For example, discrimination. Concluding observation, New Zealand, April 12, 1994, para 612. The government has passed a new Human Rights Act in 93, extending the ground of prohibited discrimination. Its grounds would now cover gender issues, including sexual orientation. Discrimination and asylum. Concluding observation, Sweden. April 2008, para 10. Committee welcomes the amendment of Swedish Alliance Act in 2006, which provide for the granting of refugee status to persons claiming fear of persecution on the grounds of gender and sexual orientation, and which will be of benefit to women refugees. Discrimination stereotypes. Concluding observations, Panama, 2010. The committee is gravely concerned that certain groups of women, in adding to being affected by gender stereotypes, face multiple forms of discrimination and violence on the ground, such as sexual orientation and gender identity. The committee also urges state party to transform its recognition of the problem of multiple forms of discrimination into an overall strategy for eliminating gender stereotypes related to women in general, and in particular to discrimination against women as specified in paragraph 22. Discrimination and violence. Concluding observations, Albania, 2010, para 1943. Committee recommends state party monitor the impact of gender inequality and anti-discrimination legislation. Anti-discrimination legislation. Identify inconsistencies and address them as appropriate, with a view to ensuring that the implementation of legislation is conducive to effective elimination of discrimination against women, especially women belonging to disadvantaged groups, such as women discriminated on grounds of their sexual orientation and gender identity. State party monitor the impact of gender inequality. The committee calls on state parties to implement fully the law on protection from discrimination in relation to discrimination based on gender identity and sexual orientation by providing effective protection against discrimination and violence against women on such grounds. Criminalization of consensual same-sex relationship. Concluding observation, Uganda, October 2010. Committee calls on state parties to decriminalize homosexual behavior and provide effective protection from violence, discrimination against women based on sexual orientation and gender identity, in particular through enactment of comprehensive anti-discrimination legislation covering inter alia the prohibition of multiple forms of discrimination against women on all grounds, including grounds of sexual orientation and gender identity. To this end, committee urges state party to oppose the private members' proposal of the homosexuality bill. And starting from 2010, CEDAW began to regularly include sexual orientation and gender identity its general recommendations, particularly in comments on intersectionality and multiple forms of discrimination. First was general recommendation number 27 on older women and protection of their human rights. The discrimination expressed by older women is often multidimensional, with the age factor compounding other forms of discrimination based on gender, ethnic origin, disability, poverty levels, sexual orientation, and gender identity, migrant status, marital family status, literacy, and other grounds. Older women who are members of minority ethnic indigenous group, internally displaced or stateless, often experience a disproportionate degree of discrimination. General recommendation number 28 on the core obligations of state parties under Article 2 of the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination, para 18. Intersectionality is a basic concept for understanding the scope of general obligation of state parties contained in Article 2. Discrimination of women based on sex and gender and explicitly linked with other factors that affect women, such as race, ethnicity, religion or belief, health status, age, class, caste, sexual orientation, and gender identity. State parties must legally recognize such intersecting forms of discrimination and their compounded negative impact on women concerned and prohibit them. They also need to adopt, pursue policies and programs designed to eliminate such occurrences, including, where appropriate, temporary special measures in accordance with Article 4, Paragraph 1 of the Convention and General Recommendation number 25. General recommendation 33 on women's access to justice of 2015 and para 1 and 8 also cover LGBTI rights. Right to access to justice is multidimensional. It encompasses justicability, availability, accessibility, good quality, accountability of justice system, and provision of remedies for victims. And noted that being lesbian, bisexual, transgender, or intersex are among intersecting factors that make it difficult to gain access to justice. And finally, General Recommendation 36 on right of girls and women on education, para 45-46, state that bullying, harassment, threats against such students, follow student and teachers constitute barriers to their right to education. Limited education and cultural taboos are among the factors that prevent lesbian, bisexual, transgender, intersex students from achieving social mobility, increase their vulnerability to violence. And committee recommends state parties address discrimination against lesbian, bisexual, and transgender women and girls and intersex persons by ensuring that policies are in place to address the obstacles that impede their access to education. But the analysis of CEDAW Committee's concluding observations show lacking of consistent approach in use of terminology, referring to LGBTI women sometimes, LGBTI women, LGBT women and intersex person, LGBTI persons, as well as use of SOGI recommendations. Standalone references are made to lesbian women, lesbian and bisexual women, to same-sex union, civil union, cohabitation, partnership. Some recommendations refer explicitly to transgender women and intersex person. In past and present, language, sexual orientation, and gender identity is the subject of the committee's long discussion. I want to note that general recommendations 27 and 28 were not adopted by consensus, but by vote. The committee was negatively affected by controversiality and discussions rose from the SOGI concept in international human rights system and social constructionist definition of gender that has been seriously contested and challenged in international human rights fora. Gender backlash encompasses activities pursued by various locally initiatives, which introduce discriminatory laws restricting freedom of expression, association, and peaceful assembly, including so-called anti-propaganda laws, and firmly promote traditional over equality. I want to note that still 69 countries have laws that criminalize private consensual sexual relationships between persons of the same sex. Such laws typically prohibit either specific type of sexual activity or an intimacy on sexual activity between persons of the same sex. However, they are also frequently used to penalize trans people regardless of their sexual orientation. Brunei, Islamic Republic of Iran, Mauritania, Saudi Arabia, Sudan, and Yemen, plus regions of Nigeria and Somalia are applying death penalty for consensual same-sex relations. Nevertheless, the committee constantly makes decisions about controversial issues when advancing women's human rights, but never regressing, and embodies continuous evolution. Each generation of experts bring forward their own experience, strategies, and ideas. Otherwise, it would be impossible to promote women's human rights and the changing world. The committee continues to increase awareness of the SOGI concept and the state parties' obligations toward LGBTI women. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Nadaria, for that very thoughtful and comprehensive overview of where the committee has addressed SOGI rights in terms of concluding observations and general recommendations, noting also that point about general recommendations 27 and 28 being adopted by vote and not consensus, and also a welcome commitment to never regressing on women's rights. So thank you so much. And I'd also like to take this opportunity to acknowledge your committee colleagues who are also here listening and attending. So we have, in addition to Dr. Nadaria, Madana Rana is here, Hilary Gabelema, and Marion Bethel, our role here. So thank you so much to the committee for making the effort to listen to these discussions, and particular thanks to you, Dr. Nadaria. So it's now, we will move to the contribution of the United Nations Independent Expert on Sexual Orientation and Gender Identity. Very unfortunately, Victor was called into an urgent meeting of the Human Rights Council with mandate holders and is unfortunately not able to join us in person today, though he does hope to pop in tomorrow to our discussions. He has, however, sent us a wonderful pre-recorded contribution that I'm going to share with you all now. That'll be, once we have Victor's contribution, we'll then move into a more open discussion and Q&A. Okay, so just bear with me while we manage the technology.
Dear colleagues, hello. I'm very grateful to the organizers of this conversation for the invitation to share with you a few ideas. I wish I could be there to participate more actively, but hopefully I can convey to you some of the work that my mandate is carrying out in relation to the issues that you will be talking about, and that will provide us with grounding for furthering the conversation in the future. As you know, I have the honor of being the independent expert on protection from violence and discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity. The mandate is crafted with the idea of, on one hand, providing visibility to the manner in which violence and discrimination occurs in the lived experience of lesbian, gay, bisexual, trans, and gender diverse persons around the world. And on the other hand, to identify effective measures that can be adopted by states to address and eventually eradicate such forms of violence and discrimination. When starting to carry out this mandate, I understood that certain issues were important points of departure. One of them, which I've seen confirmed throughout my work, is that the expressions lesbian, gay, bisexual, or trans reflect only to a limited extent the enormous diversity that exists in humankind, and they may or may not correspond to manners and political identities under which people identify themselves. The other is that the very concepts upon which the mandate is created, sexual orientation and gender identity, necessitate significant discussion within international human rights law, with the purpose of ensuring coherence, including coherence in the doctrine and the jurisprudence of global and regional courts, commissions, and other bodies. That's part of the work that my mandate is hopefully contributing to, is that understanding of the manner in which these concepts are received in international human rights law, and what are the mechanisms that can provide us with processes and tools so as to promote cohesion and therefore a better understanding. And this is a first point that I wanted to share with you in this work of promoting a more active, perhaps richer, receptions of these concepts by different treaty bodies, special procedures, and of course, the Universal Periodic Review as well. And I'm very pleased to know that in these panels, a colleague from the CEDAW is going to share with us their significant wealth of experience in relation to this matter. The work of analysis of violence and discrimination has taken my mandate to the development of a research agenda that has included topics such as criminalization, depathologization, legal recognition of gender identity, and social inclusion. In each one of these thematic projects, there has always been a demand from feminist organizations to ensure that the analysis is intersectional, but also very importantly, that there should be a differentiated approach according to different populations and communities. This is particularly relevant in the case of communities and populations that are historically disadvantaged, even within populations historically discriminated against because of sexual orientation and gender identity. I'm referring, for example, to lesbian and bisexual women. In relation to whose situation, very little data is gathered around the world. A lot less than what there is, for example, in relation to gay men. Some processes may reflect existing asymmetries of power even within the communities, but others may interact with processes such as the HIV/AIDS programming prevalent in many sections and latitudes in Africa, the Caribbean, Asia, Latin America, and Eastern Europe, where legal barriers may have made it very difficult to work on the basis of political identities, but allowed the creation of significant work on key populations of gay men and trans women, for example. So that example lets us know that we do know a lot about the health of gay men, precisely because that those processes have been there over the last few decades. Other analyses of gender-based violence and discrimination were reflected in what was said to me in a recent submission to the mandate. And I quote, the submission said, gender is a social construct deeply embedded in society as a basis for making decisions on social, economic, and political inclusion and participation on one hand, and on exclusion and marginalization on the other. End of quote. For the very few, gender identity will contribute to the creation of experiences of privilege. For others, it will lead to experiences of discrimination and violence. That is often the case for women and persons whose gender identity does not fit squarely within the male-female binary, or fits within it in a manner that does not correspond to the preconceptions attached to our understanding of sex characteristics. For these reasons, gender-based analysis has been an indispensable tool in the development of jurisprudence dealing with cases of violence and discrimination. A broad understanding of gender is inclusive of gender-based discrimination impacting persons because of their real or perceived sexual orientation, gender identity, and/or gender expression. And the interpretations issued by United Nations treaty bodies indeed suggest that these increasingly accept that gender-based analysis includes but transcends the male-female binary and requires an understanding of compounded discrimination. The CEDAW, for example, affirms that discrimination against women based on sex and/or gender is often inextricably linked with and compounded by other factors that affect women, such as being lesbian, bisexual, or trans. The Committee on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights has established that the notion of the prohibited ground sex has evolved considerably to cover not only physiological characteristics, but also the social construction of gender stereotypes. Having analyzed the state failure to allow change of sex on official documents, the Human Rights Committee concluded that it was a form of discrimination because the government is failing to afford the author and similarly situated individuals equal protection under the law. Gender-based approaches are thus analytical tools in the consideration of root causes of violence and discrimination against lesbian, bisexual, and trans women, as well as other gender-diverse persons, inasmuch as departure from what are perceived as gender norms in a particular time and place are part of the causes of said violence and discrimination. Recent inter-American case law provides good examples of how gender-based analytical tools are applicable and pertinent to the analysis of violence against trans women. In Vicky Hernandez versus Honduras, a case that is currently pending of a judgment by the Inter-American Court of Human Rights, the commission found in the merits report that the victim's death occurred in a context of discrimination based on prejudice that included police violence against LGBT persons, especially trans women sex workers, as was the case with the victim. In looking at what the case and its context demonstrate, the commission specially noted the violence based on prejudice towards the gender identity and gender expression of trans women, and took into account that Vicky Hernandez and other trans women had essentially been forced into a cycle of violence by social exclusion leading to discrimination and criminalization. The Working Group Against Discrimination Against Women and Girls has similarly highlighted the dangers of ignoring gender identity and diversity. It has observed that women who do not conform to gender stereotypes, including some who may identify as lesbians, bisexual, and trans, are particularly vulnerable to discrimination, violence, and criminalization, and has noted, and I quote, "In the 1990s, queer theory also started using the term gender, challenging what is perceived as the binary understanding of gender, sex-gender dichotomy, and the heteronormative assumptions of some feminist approaches. The mandate has already identified amongst the circumstances that can unduly restrict freedom the male-female binary system on the basis of the sex assigned at birth and the idea that persons fall neatly and exclusively into that system. In the exploration of root causes of violence and discrimination based on gender identity, derived from the dictates of the resolution that gives me my mandate, I have gathered and systematized significant evidence about harrowing levels of violence against women, men, and gender diverse persons on the basis of their sexual orientation and gender identity. And I have concluded that, like other forms of gender-based violence, this stemmed from gender norms and stereotypes that are enforced by unequal power dynamics. And it's further aggravated when they intersect with other structural inequalities resulting in poverty, homelessness, and lack of job opportunities or with other grounds for discrimination. I have particularly documented connected spirals of exclusion to which persons are subjected in connection with their gender identity, and I have noted that paradoxically, in the limited context in which data is gathered, there is abundance of proof that the situation continues. The University of Buenos Aires has produced research indicated that a trans woman is killed every 96 hours in Argentina. A survey by Stonewall with YouGov in Britain found that 4 in 5 LGBT plus people have experienced a hate crime or incident but did not report it to the police. My mandate has structured analysis around violence that includes killings, torture, and cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, arbitrary detention, and other violations to personal integrity, as well as systematic discrimination manifesting itself in health, education, employment, and housing sectors, as well as measures that promote sociocultural inclusion, such as inclusive policies in relation to sports. Over time, United Nations human rights mechanisms have increasingly linked the phenomena of stereotype, social constructions, women oppression, and power. The Human Rights Committee has explicitly adopted gender-based frameworks in finding that the right to life must be respected and ensured without distinction of any kind, expressly forbidding distinction based on gender, acknowledging multiple and intersectional forms of discrimination, and these approaches place the victim's gender in the wider social context, acknowledging how social constructions of gender may mean that femicide and rape takes on a particularly egregious and discriminatory character, or have concrete implications for the analysis of cases brought to the consideration of treaty bodies. I would like to commend, in that context, the conversation that you are about to have today. It's obvious that all of these issues are inextricably connected. And I would invite that in your conversations, you also explore the connection with urgent agendas, such as current narratives that question the prevalence of the human rights of trans persons, the notion that gender identity is a concept received in international human rights law, and the connection with all of these systems of power and asymmetries of power with foundational causes such as colonialism. This is a work in which my mandate is very much embarking over the next 2 years, and where I'm very much hoping to learn the result of your conversations, also to be able to bring them into the overview of the mandate of the independent expert. Again, thank you very much for this invitation, and I look forward to learning of the result of your work. Thank you very much.
So a really rich contribution from the independent expert, starting by noting the underdocumentation of many violations and experiences of LGBT and non-gender normative women, noting also some promising developments from the intra-American system in this area. Throughout, I think noting the richness, potential richness of the term gender, and also raising at the end a call to action around urgent agendas. But to thank all of our opening contributors, in particular Dr. Nadaria, who's here, for I think giving us a wonderful opening to the next 2 days in terms of workshops, in terms of our discussions. So this is an opportunity really to have a more open discussion. I'm going to encourage the workshop participants to speak up, turn on your cameras, speak up, raise your hand. And particularly, I think I'd like to invite if any of the CEDAW committee members who are here have any reflections or contributions, certainly we'd be very pleased to hear from you. So with that, I think I might turn to my colleague, Megan, who I know has a couple of points that she'd like to make.
Yeah, thank you so much. And thank both Leah and Victor for the really wonderful opening remarks. I have one question for Leah and then one question for one of our participants, Sandra Duffy. My first question for Leah is, how important is civil society in bringing forward issues of sexual orientation and gender identity for the work of the committee? Like, just how much do you need and rely on them to bring these issues forward? And my question for Sandra is around, Victor mentioned, I'm only bringing Sandra into this because I know she's written a wonderful article in Modern Law Review discussing some of these issues. And Victor talked about how even the terminology around sexual orientation, gender identity can unwittingly replicate colonialist patterns. I'm wondering if you could share some of your insights into how we even speak about these issues as a in a way to ensure that we're not replicating colonial patterns or global North dominance.
Okay. Will I start?
Please do. Sorry. Thank you so much.
Okay. Civil society is crucial for life of treaty bodies. We rely on data collected by civil society. So in respect to LGBTI questions, we are lacking data, and it is obvious that we do not have the same quantity of that quality data as in other areas of human women's human rights. And it's a pity because I think we should our partnership is based on mutual exchange on sources on civil society, and I hope that entire process of data collection and work with treaty bodies will continue to evolve and develop and progress.
Will I pick up next? Yeah. All right. Thank you very much for the question, Megan. It's I think quite an important point to make. I'm not sure if I'm. There we go. First of all, I would just like to respond to Victor's contributions by saying it was incredibly important as a scholar of, in particular, trans studies within law. I found his call to action with regard to defending the rights of trans persons to be really important. And I'm really glad that gender identity is such a focus of this workshop as well. With regard to the terms and the terminology we use and that are used within the UN itself, a lot of my research in this area has discovered that a lot of the terms that are used have historically been very westernized terms. So I use the term normative westernization. It has gotten better in that we have moved away from the terminology of LGBT to SOGI within the past decade or so, SOGI being sexual orientation and gender identity, but even that retains a focus which comes from a quite a Eurocentric, quite a Western viewpoint. So in relation to your specific question, Megan, with regard to the terms, just taking the terms lesbian, bisexual, and transgender, those can be seen as a particularly westernized view of relationships and gender identity that do not always reflect the diversity and the nuances of sexual and gendered identities that exist, especially in the global south. What is particularly noticeable, I suppose, in the context of women is that a lot of cultures have specific cultures of trans feminine persons or trans women or third gender persons with a feminine gender expression who, you know, suffer from both misogyny and trans misogyny, but are not necessarily included in what we would consider to be the Western definition of transgender, which is often seen as a binary transition from, you know, point A on the male or female binary to point B. And I just think it's quite important that we make sure that in order to reflect an actually global outlook, that we use language that is inclusive so that we recognize different cultures, different socially and culturally located identities and that we don't attempt to put everybody into a constricted and quite westernized normative box. I can elaborate on any of that if you'd like me to, but.
Thanks so much, Sandra. We've a couple of hands up here. So Ksenia and Loveday have asked to come in. Hi, Ksenia.
Hello. Hi, I'm Ksenia, and I work for ILGA World, which is a global LGBTI federation of organizations. And specifically, I worked a lot with CEDAW, and even before when I was like a Russian human rights defender. So I have a lot of experience with CEDAW and specifically Sochi. I have a question to CEDAW members, but before maybe I would just like to comment on the question regarding this terminology, because you know, at ILGA World, we are thinking about what terminology would be the best, taking into account that indeed sometimes we leave behind specific cultural / gender identities, such as, for example, hijra in India or Pakistan, and other identities as well. But for me, it's also as a feminist, intersectional feminist, and as a lesbian activist, for me, the question is also that when we shift from LGBTI to Sojiesque, it means that we are losing these intersections between gender and sexuality specifically. And the LGBTI, just by definition, it includes these intersections and specifically lesbian women. While when we are speaking about Sojiesque, it's not like directly per se includes gender aspects. So that's just like what I'm thinking about and how we can better address these issues, because even though, of course, intersectionality is not only about identities, but also systems of oppression, I think that situations of lesbian women should be also addressed and not lost in all these discussions. And regarding the cultural identities, I know that because we work with different treaty bodies, I know that some of the committees, still not CEDAW, but some of the committees, they did address specifically the situation of hijra, specifically in, I think, in Pakistan. And it also relates to what information civil society provides, of course, but I think that there is one of the gaps that CEDAW maybe could address in the future, because indeed there are two-spirit people, for example, in North America, there are hijras in India and Pakistan, there are also fafafine in Pacific and so on and so forth. So that's kind of my thoughts about the terminology. And then the question to CEDAW committees. So, Dr. Nadaraya indeed shared that CEDAW made the highest number of recommendations on LGBTI, and that's true because we are also analyzing and collecting this information since 2014, and we see that CEDAW is the most active among all other treaty bodies in this field. But my question is, what still remaining gaps you see in relation to sexual orientation or gender identity or LGBTI? So what, at least in theory, in the ideal world, CEDAW could do more to advance the rights of LGBTI women and persons? So that's my first question, what are still remaining gaps? And the second question is, what are the impediments you face when you work to advance the rights of LGBTI women and persons? Because maybe Human Rights Council, we can see it as more political. CEDAW, because it based its work on like treaty specific convention, we may think that it's more like less political and more legal. And therefore, one, maybe some people think that it affects to the last extent, by this, all these political interventions and different positions. But what is your opinion? Maybe it's like a composition of the committee, maybe it's pressure from the states, but what is the reasons why you have still like these limitations to advance more the rights of LGBTI persons and Sojiesque generally?
Those are really wonderful and rich questions. Thank you so much. Dr. Nadaraya, I'd like to give you an opportunity to respond if you would like.
Yes, I will start from the last question. I think it's, I would not say that CEDAW is less political and more legal. CEDAW has its political heaviness, let's say so. And sure, we depend on composition of committee. Usually this is a main, what is we are working, each of us brings our own aspirations. So it has immense impact on decisions we make. I think that first of all, there is a lack of discussion. And I would say lack of academic discussion around the topic. I don't see enough briefings in this direction, enough interaction with academics, enough communication with state parties who press us. And there is always threat that, for example, that SOGI concept is a reason for withdrawal of Istanbul Convention, and if we start pushing forward issues connected with SOGIEST and will be referring more frequently, it might cause threat to withdraw from CEDAW. So we are all the time under attack of outside political pressure. And it's voiced inside of the committee, though I can say that it's not supported by entire committee, but there is a always hot debate, para after para. Every other occasion, the same arguments arise, and it's a bit tedious in a way that we can't move on forward. And I think there should be a greater link with academics, greater link with human rights outside that will strengthen committee to voice itself, to voice it, and not be all the time traumatized and harassed by threat from outside the world and political decisions of some very strong states. That's my personal view. So we need again to communicate better, and this is matter of communication, and it's matter of expansion of ideas, matter of communication with people on the ground. That's what treaty bodies are really lacking, and hope that Zoom will allow us to swim more openly. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Nadaria. That was that important call to action, and likewise a call to us in the academy to engage more directly and specifically on this issue. With that, I'm going to turn to my colleague Loveday. Loveday, would you like to contribute?
Hi, thanks, Catherine. I just wanted to, I suppose, continue that discussion in some respect. It's been the important discussion that's been raised by Dr. Nadaria about the politicization of the committee's work. In particular, I wanted to go back to the question of consensus, because we've touched on the important point that more recent general recommendations have not been adopted by consensus. And I guess what we're indicating is a clear division within the committee, or certain areas where agreement can't be reached. And I wonder, this is a question for any committee member here, really, how whether that sort of, I guess, coincides with your understanding of what the committee's function is, to kind of face these divisions head on and to you know, accept the sort of challenging nature of some of the questions that are being raised here. So how does the lack of consensus figure in your understanding of what the committee is doing? Is it problematic or is it invigorating? I guess would be one way of phrasing the question. And we've had, if I can just follow that up with a question that I think touches on a similar area. We've had a question in the question and answers from an anonymous attendee about plurality with respect specifically here to Indian society and different laws governing marriage. And so I suppose the question extends to where those divisions are based on religious differences, not least, and cultural plurality. Does that add anything to the complexity of your task? So I don't know if that's manageable as a question, but those are certainly my own questions that I'm starting out with here. Thanks.
Yes, this is Marion Bethel speaking here. And I'd just like, thank you very much for that, for these questions. And I'd like to support what Leonardo Raya has put forward as some of the issues that we face in the committee, which I think reflects the global context. And yes, I find it invigorating in regard to the question, part of the question that was asked, as to how do we move forward. And I think the alliances that we have now, the kind of workshop that we're engaged in this very moment, I think all contribute to us conceptualizing and imagining a way forward to CEDAW fully protecting the rights, human rights of the LBTI SOGI community. I think that is the goalpost, and as I've said, this particular kind of conversation with academics, NGOs, and other bodies, including the special rapporteur, are crucial to how we conceive of a way forward. And I think for my part, in terms of the convention itself and the binary of male female that it has set up, I think there are definitely ways forward. We have GRs that are used to interpret the different aspects or articles of the convention. And yes, some are done by vote, some are done by consensus. Those that are reached by consensus are clearly more clearly easier to use both internally and externally. And we do have the issue of GR 28, which interprets intersectionality and sexual orientation and gender identity. And there are difficulties moving forward when we, in terms of terminology, in terms of how gender itself, the word has evolved. It remains to some extent not evolving as our understanding, in our understanding of it in the committee. And that is in the global context. But for my part, I think that every single article of the convention ought to include the SOGI LBTI women. Every single article. I think Article 5, for example, which deals with social and cultural attitudes, ought to be used extensively to address this issue of SOGI and LBTI women in terms of stereotyping and how we in the community, in different communities, view that. I think temporary special measures under Article 7 is also crucial. Sorry, Article 4, temporary special measures, ought to be given to the LBTI SOGI community in order to advance the cause of human rights for these women. And as we look at the CSW, Article 7, I think is important for women to LBTI women to step forward, to be to enabling environment for LBTI women to have political power, political decision making, and leadership in all levels. And so I think we in the CEDAW committee can bring these concerns under each and every article, and we must do that. It's not relegated just to health issues, for the LBTI community or violence against the LBTI community, but every single article has the opportunity to introduce and advance the human rights of the LBTI SOGI community under CEDAW. And that is my position. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Ms. Patel, for coming in and for joining our discussions. I'm conscious, mindful of time. We have formally reached the end of the session. So before we bring it to a full conclusion, I first would like to note just an interesting question that's come in through the Q&A from our attendees, which is something that I hope we'll get to through the course of the next 2 days. Even if the CEDAW committee states SOGI in the recommendations, the convention itself is based on a gender binary. How do you think we could overcome this obstacle? So of course, that's something that we're trying to address in our full discussions. And before I wrap up completely, I would just like to give Dr. Dadaria an opportunity for the final word before we wrap up.
Thank you very much. And my final word will be that CEDAW was born and was born based on gender binary, but it has evolved through its through the development of concept of gender. Let's start first of all from this, from all constructivist movements around which CEDAW observed in it. So today CEDAW is enough articulative to address intersectionality and multidimensional differences in sexual orientation and gender identity. That's my understanding. The way convention develops, there was no violence against women when CEDAW was born. There was no article covering violence against women. But we have developed one of the best jurisprudence on violence against women. And I think GR35 is in a high level. So let's believe in evolution and progress.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. That is such a fitting note on which to conclude this, our opening panel session. I just want to reiterate my thanks to Dr. Dadaria, to all the committee members who are here, and indeed to the independent expert who, whilst not here in person, has made a really wonderful contribution through his video. So we're going to formally conclude this session now. I'll invite you all to take a comfort break and to rejoin us at 3:30, where we'll move into our first thematic panel, which is looking at relationships and families. So thank you, and we'll see you soon.